What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Yalla, your thrice weekly podcast where we talk about the hottest news with some very interesting people sometimes, all with a touch of what, Terrence?
Good old humor.
Good old humor, man.
Yeah.
So today is one of those special episodes where we have someone in front of us who actually does some super cool stuff with the company he's with, but also helped us a lot last year.
Actually, a year ago. Yeah, exactly. Almost a year ago.
Oh, shit. It is almost the anniversary of the article coming out.
Yeah.
And he is none other than the chief editor of Tech in Asia, Terrence Lee.
Yeah.
Welcome to Yalla Bud, man.
Great to be here, man.
Yeah.
So just to give some context to our listeners, last year when we went public with the whole shit show that was the liquidation of Hook that affected us and the TV show we never got to show the world, Terrence Lee was one of the people who really helped us get the story out, because you and your teammate Colin Furtado wrote a great article that kind of showed, like, explain the technicalities of what went down. And we really, really appreciate that, because it was almost cathartic for us to get the story out.
We thought it was a good idea to kind of shed light into what happens in a liquidation, because it's very technical, right? Very business. So kind of put the human side to it. I thought that was a great story.
But Tech in Asia especially in recent times, has to build a reputation for, you know, breaking news. A lot of times about things that go on in the corporate world that you might not read so often on mainstream media, or might not catch like the editor's attention on mainstream media. But you guys have pursued stories that I found very interesting, and of companies that everyone has heard of, but maybe because they're startups, they're not on the stock market or anything yet. We don't have as much public information about them, right? Broadly, what kind of journalism do you call it? Is it like investigative or journalism or what?
So yeah, investigative journalism is something we pride ourselves on. If you go back to define what journalism is, it's really just printing stuff that people don't want you to print. So that's it, right? So I think investigative journalism flows out of that. We don't just want to print the good side of things, right? This company raised like tons of money, but the flip side of that is how do they manage the money? How do they spend it? Whether there's any mismanagement. So we like to go into that as well. And if you are like an entrepreneur, you're a founder, there's a lot you can learn from those failures, right? Or those mistakes that others make. So that's kind of what pushes us into doing this kind of journalism. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you've been at Tech in Asia for how long?
Close to 11 years.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, my first job was in tech journalism. So that was like my first job right out the gate. So I did that at another website for like 3 years, then got the website got acquired by Tech in Asia. And that's how I joined. And now Tech in Asia is acquired by, SPH Media. So yeah, that's how my life is.
So you've been basically in journalism your entire career.
Pretty much. Yeah. So, in college as well, I was in mass comm, right? Exploring, journalism as a career. Yeah, had my doubts, but yeah, stuck to it. Mm. So tech is natural to me because I'm a bit on the geekier side, right? I like playing around with computers.
Yeah.
I'm not a programmer, but maybe in another life I might have been. So that's kind of my journey. Yeah.
So that means at the start you had always been interested in tech.
Yeah. So yeah, I like playing around with computers a little bit.
So
I wasn't like a child prodigy or something. I wasn't coding when I was a kid, but I did enjoy technology. Yes, reading TechCrunch as a college student.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I love to write, right? So putting those two together is almost a dream job, right?
So when you were studying comms, you already kind of knew you wanted to go down tech, or you were still kind of exploring?
Yeah. So yeah, I was with the Online Citizen, right? So I was dabbling in current affairs and political coverage.
Mm.
Uh, much more political then. I mean, yeah, we all were, right? No bills to pay, right? No money to worry about. So, yeah, so I dabbled in that. Yeah, I interned at a bunch of different places at both SPH and MediaCorp. So, kind of just exploring a bit. Yeah. So, yeah, tech really came into the picture towards graduation, right? Where, okay, what do I do next? So, yeah, so there's a job opening, applied for it. Yeah.
But back then, like when you're talking about 11, 12 years ago, tech was a very different space from what it is now, right? Like now it's like, the you know, a lot of times when people talk about tech, we're talking about the biggest companies in the world, people, like young people flocking to work in all these tech companies and all that. Back then, was it as sexy as it sounds today?
Definitely not. So back then, the startup scene here was very nascent. You could fit everyone into a room, really.
Okay.
And then you look at the broader region as well. Some of the biggest companies we know today were tiny, right? They were startups back then. Yeah. I don't even know if Grab, when was Grab born, right? Like I think back then, they were not even on the radar.
Yeah,
I think they were still known, maybe known as Grab Taxi. They were in Malaysia. They weren't even known as a Singapore company, right?
Yeah.
So, a very, very tiny scene, and then it just blew up, right? Because, funding started coming in, and these companies just multiplied, right? And grew in size, yeah.
Yeah, but are you shocked by how rapid that change has happened?
A little bit, right? Especially towards 2021, where the tech bubble hadn't burst yet.
Yeah.
Interest rates were zero. Just every day you hear like, oh, this company raised tens of millions, a company raised hundreds of millions. And I've never been through that, right? But if you're old enough, maybe you've been through the tech bubble in 2000.
Yeah, 2000.
That is probably the closest thing to this, right?
Yeah.
So I was just covering the scene and experiencing it, and then it burst, right? So, so I think, you know, walking away from this, it does give me a sense, this is what the tech bubble in 2000 felt like. It's pretty similar, right?
But when you joined like 11, 12 years ago, were people around you thinking, hey, Terrence, why are you going into tech? You know, there's no, like Singapore is never going to be on the level of Silicon Valley. Do you get that sort of naysayers?
Not really, because I think by then, the government was starting to put money into the startup scene. So there's this program where they would co-invest with venture capital firms into startups. So like the VC firm would put $1, then the government would match with another dollar, something like that. So there was a really support, right? So, but it just wasn't as well covered as it is today. Where today there's just a lot of coverage of startups, but back then much less so. So back then it was already on the rise, so I kind of joined at the right time.
I mean, I didn't go through the tech bubble in the 2000s the year 2000 or anything, but I do remember quite distinctly, like when I was looking for internships in university and all that, it was all about joining a bank or a consultancy or that. It never thought about, going to join Facebook or something like that, But now it's like the only place that people want to go and intern is at all the big tech companies. And that tells me in such a short time, the whole industry has become like the sexiest employer out there. But for you, like seeing, all this whole thing rise and sort of like, having a bit of a down period, if anything, right now. What has been the most, the biggest takeaway for you from all these years of like covering this industry that has gone through many very, very high highs and now also going through a sudden low period and all?
Yeah, you start to get a good sense of what bullshit is, right? So, right, not just talk about Singapore, but even the US.
Yeah.
You read about Theranos, you read about just cult of personalities.
Yeah.
You read about how certain founders or CEOs implement this very top-down culture, right, where it's, do as I say, don't ask questions. How information is siloed, right? How they keep teams in the dark. And then you start to see, this is how certain companies are run. So that gives you a sense of like, what are some traits of a good company versus a bad one, right? So, I mean, there's a lot of takeaways. I think but that said, it's really hard to run a company and raise money and, oh, you're suddenly expected to grow 10x, right?
Yeah.
And suddenly you have to hire like 1,000 people. To be honest, yeah, I don't know how people do that. It's crazy. Yeah. And so not exactly surprised at some of the blowback, right? Mm-hmm. And how some companies subsequently have to do layoffs.
Yeah.
It's pretty, nuts. Like I'm a bit quite sympathetic, to be honest, because
Wait, to the companies or
companies, to
founders.
To the founders as well, to employees, right? Mm-hmm. Who have to go through all of that. Yeah. Because it's crazy. VC money isn't for everyone, because especially in that period of time, once you raise, you have to go on this crazy
growth at all costs.
Yeah, just grow at all costs, blitz scaling, right? So, which isn't healthy, right? So, now it's a very different tune, right? Everyone's talking about profitability, grow sustainably.
Mm.
Yeah.
I mean, interesting that you your first answer is that you can. You're able to discern the bullshit, right? Because there's you mentioned the stories of Theranos and all these things. There were quite adversarial relationships between the startup and the journalists, right? And even the Wall Street Journal that tried to dig into all these stories. But for you, like all these years, where do you see, what's the role of this tech journalist vis-a-vis the startup ecosystem and all? Are you there to really uncover the bullshit and really dig into all these things that, is it just part of startup life, or are you there to cheerlead and rah-rah the troops, everyone together as a startup ecosystem? Yeah. Where do you see your role?
I think it's a bit of both. You have to do both, right? You can't be so anti-startup and then that wouldn't be balanced, right? So I like Tech and Asia's, our mission is to kind of serve and build the startup ecosystem, the tech ecosystem. So we have to cover startups in a I would say positive light as well.
Mm-hmm.
So most of our coverage is the usual stuff, right? So so-and-so company raise money from so-and-so investors. So I think earlier on, we just weren't equipped to do investigative journalism. So most of our coverage, I would say, was maybe superficial or positive.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then we started getting better at it. And then we started doing more digging.
Mm.
So I think people appreciate what we're doing, how we are shedding light into some of the malpractices at the startups. I think it's also a matter of timing. So I remember when we covered Honestbee, that was a few years back.
Yeah.
I think someone was telling us, how come you uncovered them so late, right? Mm. So, I mean, my honest answer was that when Honestbee was on the rise, we just weren't equipped, right? It wasn't, in something that we can do well. So now I think we are in a better position. Like we try to be a bit more questioning of certain up and coming startups. If there's someone is telling us to look more closely at a particular startup, we'll do so.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, just a lot of lessons learned along the way. Yeah.
Okay. But so at what point, say like an example like Honestbee, right?
Mm.
At what point do you make the decision, okay, we got to put on that investigative journalist hat and dig a bit deeper into something, as opposed to, just talking to the founders and, they're struggling through certain things, and that's just part of the startup story, right? It's always a struggle every day. At what point do you feel like, okay, this is something I want to take up? Is there an ethical or moral kind of angle to when you decide, okay, we want to pursue the story further?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it comes down to what evidence you get, because it's harder to write a negative story about a startup that's on the rise, right?
Yeah.
Because, everyone, they are like the darlings, the media darlings, right? Mm. So you're going against the grain.
Mm. Mm.
So it's definitely much harder unless some whistleblower gives you very solid evidence that you can base your story on. It's going to be very difficult. So I think in certain situations, it's really about the right moment. I think if we talk about honesty, it's things started going downhill when they did a bunch of layoffs, right? Then they started pissing people off.
Yeah,
more people started coming out and things spiral and snowball from there. So I think it's about, I mean, journalists, we work with what we can get, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, we even if we hear stuff, but if no one wants to talk or there's no evidence, it's very difficult. These days, we look a lot more at court cases.
Oh, okay.
So there's like ongoing legal court cases that gives us a lot of things to work with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you know, like going back to what you said, I mean, you said earlier that, you know, you also want to show the balance take on the startup ecosystem. But for you or your team, right, what is the why that you do what you do? Because, for example, right, our podcast, we called it Yalla Butt because we got sick of the news. You read one hand, one paper, you just get one opinion. You read the alternative, you get another opinion. Why we always like to talk about the darker side of stuff is because, I mean, even our own experience with Hook, we're like, this is fucked up bullshit that people need to know.
Mm.
So that is what always lights a fire under our ass. But for you, right, be it personally and or your team, what is the thing that drives you guys?
Mm.
Like, why? Why you want to be a Debbie Downer on all these people who are coming up?
Yeah. I think it's to just keep people accountable, right? So we want to kind of expose, you know, we want, obviously, the good actors to thrive, right? And we want them to do well. So every dollar that you put into a bad startup, you know, you're kind of depriving another startup of a good startup of that same dollar.
Yeah.
So I think it's a way of telling the ecosystem, the startup community that, hey, you know, there are repercussions to mismanagement, to lying about things. So it's kind of to do that, to hold up a mirror to the industry and say that, hey, there may be consequences if you do the wrong thing. I mean, we won't kid ourselves and say that, yeah, a lot of our stories probably didn't lead to change, right? Or rather, it's not something we can track. But at least people know that, you know, like if a startup has done something they shouldn't have done, they can go to Tech in Asia. Or at least that there's some kind of light that's shown on what's really happening in the startup world. And hopefully, we educate people about what can go wrong so that they don't repeat the same mistakes. Or if you're an employee, right, you kind of understand, okay, this is how bad startups are run, right? So avoid that, right? So it's the education element and also just helping the industry to be accountable.
I mean, the aspect of education is important. Like, even our own experience, to be honest, it wasn't an easy decision for us to say, hey, let's go public with this story or so. And I think it's after talking to you guys and sort of even just understanding, like what Harish said, your why of why is this a story and why we shouldn't just keep quiet about it, right? Because that had been what was being told to us. So like that had been told to us for like 2 to 3 years, you know, just keep quiet, you know, don't let it get out there. And being very Singaporean, we are like, oh, yeah, don't rock the boat and all these things. But after a while, it became clearer and clearer to us that, you know, if we didn't say something, we'd just be carrying this cross on our backs for the rest of our lives, right? But it did need probably, you know, some kind of understanding, you know, why this is important. And like what you mentioned, you know, educating people, letting them know that it's not the end if something like this happens to you and there can be something learned from it.
Yeah. But I mean, yeah, let's be honest. I think people love gossip. You want to know who screwed up, right? It's why we're there. Like, you know, like I think, you know, when there's blood spilled, you know, it's a story.
Yeah.
So let's not, I mean, there's drama. People want to be about drama. But I think for us, it's also like, I mean, we just want to do it responsibly. Like, it can't be just drama for drama's sake. There has to be some education element. Yeah.
That's it, right? Yeah. So when someone like, say, Theranos, like Elizabeth Holmes, or even like, I think there was that
Harsh Dalal.
Harsh Dalal, that kid. Where it was really, I mean, they were propped up almost by the media that you know, didn't dig very deep into their backgrounds. And it took more digging from, you know, yourselves and other people to really realize that, hey, this guy is using the media as his platform to enhance himself and to get that dollar that could have gone to someone else. At what point do you think, like, where does the responsibility lie for the journalists, in those kind of situations when they've built up this cult of personality so much that you know, people made investing decisions based on that and all?
Yeah. To be fair to the media, you know, often it's just time pressure. You can't really look into things. You can't assume that every company is bad, right? So, like, even on Tech in Asia, we've covered a lot of startups that later on turn out to be not so great.
Mm.
So it's like you there's the implicit trust that the information you sent me is real, because if we start looking into every dark corner, it's just not going to be a sustainable business, right? So I think how the media should be responsible is the follow up, right? So so we covered Harsh Dalal, right? So if someone tells us something about Harsh Dalal, we should investigate it as quickly as we can and kind of minimize the negative impact of that coverage. So I think I think the media should definitely try its best to kind of salvage the situation, right? Mm. If you propped up this founder that turns out to be a fraud, then what are you going to do about it, right? So I think the media does have the responsibility to kind of correct itself. It's best that they correct themselves before other media correct them, right? So I think there's, I mean, if, I mean, my credibility is at stake, right? I don't want another outlet to come and say that my report was bullshit, right?
Yeah.
So I think there's that self-preservation element as well. I think at the same time, we can't expect the media to be perfect, because it's just so much news that comes in every day. So unless, as a media outlet, you decide, I don't want to cover news, I just want to do deep dives, which is, I think, a valid strategy, but it depends on what works for each particular media outlet as well. Yeah.
And for context for our listeners who may not have heard the word Harsh Dalal, he was the guy who appeared on Forbes 30 Under 30. Mm. And I think it was you guys broke the news, right? And I think that was one of my favorite articles that you all have done. And along the way, you did post about how even internally, you all had to decide whether or not to go. Because he was young, he was 19, right? Mm. What was the thought process there? Because you guys did, you did speak, I think it was a LinkedIn post talking about how it was not a very clear-cut decision either, right? Whether to go public.
Yeah. So, I mean, he's a youngster, right? So, he hasn't done NS even at the time. So, and now he's in NS. Curious how he's doing. Back then, I think, I mean, we kind of knew there's a story. I mean, I think there was a story. I think it's more of like, how do we not overdo it, right? Mm. So, to give you an example, we wanted to do like a follow-up video containing like some audio clips from the recording. But I think internally some of us were uncomfortable, right? Okay, like
recording with him, is
with
it?
Him involved, like from our interview. Some audio and some video images, and we kind of splice things together. But yeah, in the end, I think some of us were not comfortable with that, because I mean, we've already published that big story, right? And some follow-up stories. So we felt like, okay, we've done enough, right? So let's stop, right? I think thinking back, I think it was a fine decision. Probably would have done it the same way.
But like with Forbes, did it cause any kind of like, I mean, Forbes, they do profile tech entrepreneurs, right?
Mm-hmm.
How did that go? Because I think any media player in Singapore, to is monetizing and being sustainable is hard. At some point, you got to work with brands, right? Forbes is a huge brand. Was that part of the discussion, or did it have any spillover consequences?
I'm not aware if there were, what were the consequences?
Never get invited to the Forbes 30 Under 30 event.
I've never been even. but the Forbes 30 Under 30 thing has been, it's not just harsh, right? There were a few examples.
Mm. Mm.
I think Theranos, Holmes was part of it? Yeah,
maybe in America. Yeah.
Yeah, I think several others.
Yeah.
So harsh was like part of a larger thing.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's not like it's still story first lah, that guides you guys.
Meaning?
Like, you know, when you think about stuff, like in some way you might ruffle feathers who might be your potential brand partners or anything.
Mm.
So how do you navigate that?
I mean, we don't care lah. Like I think I remember this situation where we were investigating a company even while we were negotiating a commercial deal.
Mm. Oh
yeah, then just do it lah, right? I think for us, yeah, we still maintain that separation of editorial and commercial content.
Mm. Mm.
So I mean, that rarely happens lah. I think usually that it's not such a we don't happen to be investigating while negotiating at the same time. Rarely happens, but when it does happen, it happens lah. So I think we make it clear to our brand partners that this is what we do. But so far, it hasn't, I don't think, not that we know of, it hasn't really affected us commercially.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if it does, they wouldn't tell us, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure, in some way it probably did affect us, but then we just have to, I mean, it's really about principles, right? So we wouldn't let commercial considerations affect our journalism. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's quite interesting because you've been, I mean, we went all the way to the start of your career and then how you've grown with Tech in Asia. So I'm sure Tech in Asia itself also has evolved over the years, you know, through the boom years and everything, and just learning capabilities of like doing investigative journalism and all that. Mm-hmm. And even culminating in being part of SPH now, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, do you see it as like a, how was that moment like? Was it like a crowning glory to
SPH and everything? Interesting question. Crowning glory.
The proudest moment of your life.
I want to be a journalist, you know. Yeah. That's what you say when it's a SPH college.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't expecting it, the exit, right? So it was a surprise and a good one. I mean, the deal terms were quite favorable. So I mean, I can't talk about exact numbers, but you can dig around. It's probably out there, but so we weren't expecting it, so and especially in last year's environment, it wasn't very positive, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was right in the middle of a tech winter, so for us to get that exit, I think I think there's definitely a larger mission at play.
Mm-hmm.
As to why SPH Media acquired us, which was they see us as part of the solution towards trying to sort of like reinvent themselves, right?
Sure.
So I think that's no secret. So they see us as perhaps part of the solution.
Mm.
Yeah. So I think that's why the acquisition came about. I think our culture at Tech in Asia, quite unique, very data-driven. I think one thing I see with a lot of media companies is that it's often very hard to directly link content to revenue.
Mm.
So we are able to do that. And I think we're very disciplined about data, right? So a lot more so than many other media outlets. So I think a number of different things, our culture, I think is what they value, the brand as well. We have traction within the tech community.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of different things. Also our events business, conference business. I think that's interesting to them. Mm. Yeah.
But I remember reading about the acquisition. I was like, oh shit, is tech in Asia going to lose a bit of their edge? But I mean, I will say that just from looking at your posts and the stuff that you guys are doing, it feels you guys have been given like more, I mean, you all are doing even more incisive stuff. Was there a change or for you, it's just a natural progression?
So to SPH Media's credit, they've kept us very independent. So there's no meddling. We still maintain our HR policy. I mean we're still in the first year lah. So quite optimistic that will remain the case. Because our brand's pretty strong. So it's not a case where we'll kind of merge into them and we'll decommission our website. In fact, quite the opposite. I think there's value in Tech in Asia existing alongside the Business Times, which is our closest partner in this. So we've kept very independent. The Visio story came out soon after the acquisition. After the acquisition, we launched this feature called Glass Wall, which allows startups to review VCs, investors. So I wouldn't say it's emboldened us because I mean we've done all of these things anyway, but it does kind of give us that certain backing as well.
Did you have to convince people internally, like, you know, town halls and all that, of why this was a important decision and the right decision to make for you guys? Because I'm sure even like within your organization, it's like 100 over people, right? People have different views about being part of a larger media company and all that.
I think the reaction wasn't too negative. Actually, wasn't very negative at all. I think it's more curiosity is how I put it. I think that there are the usual questions around what happens post M&A, right? So whether, you know, will there be any layoffs, right? Which is what you see often happen. But so far, there hasn't been any layoffs. So in fact, we're going to hire more. So I think that, questions were just around how things are going to change. And to be honest, we can't really give an answer because everything looks good on paper, right? In theory, this should make sense. But when you go down to the finer details, things might have to change. So we can talk, like, we can do a lot of napkin math, theorizing about, the synergy, right, of 1 + 1 = 3. But does it actually work, right, when you get married, right? It's way more complicated than marriage, right? This combination. So it's a lot to figure out, but still very early.
In the space, do you all ever get some pushback saying like, hey, Terrence, don't get off your high horse, you know? Why do you all think you all know the best and who gives you the moral authority to decide what is good and what is bad? Do you ever get pushback like that?
Good is bad, meaning what?
Like, you know, sometimes when we get comments saying, oh, look at these two people just sitting in a room talking about politicians and like, you don't, like, you know, you always have that one friend who has this moral high horse kind of thing.
So what my ex-colleague was telling me that, investor told him, oh, you're making our jobs very difficult. We do get some pushback, right? Like often when we do some digging into a company, we'll get pushback. Like, why are you digging into this? This is not a productive use of time. It's a distraction. different variations of that. So we do get pushback. But at the same time, we let the numbers do the talking. So investigative stories are one of our top converting articles. So clearly there's demand, right? There's people are willing to pay this demand. So commercial reasons, lor. But I mean, that said, investigative stories do bring in the money, but they're expensive. I think, we just do what the community wants us to do. And even though they are critics, there are also a lot of people that support what we're doing and appreciate that we are looking into these companies. Yeah.
And then, you know, when you watch Hollywood movies about these exposés that journalists come up with in these big corporates, or there's always this moment when they're like, oh, should I publish a story? Should I not? And then they publish and they're like, boom, like the whole thing goes viral. And then, you know, the story is a huge story overnight. Like, what was that moment for you? That the biggest moment when you're published and after that, everything just went through the roof and you felt like you did something good for humanity.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that moment before you hit the publish button is real.
Yeah, already.
Like, shit, okay, this story is about to go out.
And normally it's you or like?
It's nowadays less me. It's usually the team, right? Different people working on the story. But I mean, I definitely felt it lah. When I have to hit the publish button, you're like, okay.
It's like one button in the conference room that you have to hit and then publishes.
Publish like a big red button. Or maybe they have like to do the double key kind of thing.
How's that? Is it? Or is it just like much
enter,
less?
Just enter
on the keyboard.
Yeah, just press a button. There's a pop-up. Say, are you sure? Then publish this. Then click yes. Yeah.
And then there's no turning back after that.
There's no turning back. Because, you can't... for such stories... no use taking down, right? Because someone's going to screenshot it.
Correct,
I mean, we've had our moments as well where we made mistakes, right? So there was years back, this was when we were not so great, right? So like we did this story that turned out to be false, I think.
Oh, okay.
Or we didn't put in like proper procedures and hit publish. It goes viral. Then you started hearing, all the... you started hearing word that, the story might not be true.
Oh,
yeah. So I have to take it down and paisei lah, that one. But I think nowadays we more or less get everything right lah. There's that nervousness. Then you publish. Sometimes it's anticlimactic lah. Story doesn't do well. Then, shit. Yeah, spend so much time on it. Then doesn't do well. So sometimes you immediately know, like with certain stories, you see the traffic, the real-time traffic, right? And if it's at a certain level, you kind of know, okay, this story is going to convert. So, then there's that high of like, oh, this story is doing well. Then there's the blowback, I wait for them to reach out to you or like send you a letter of demand or something. Yeah.
So which story was the big one for you? Like in all your years?
So big ones, Honest B. Yeah, but I shouldn't talk so much about it because, one of the co-founders, is a friend. So it's like always, why you keep talking about Honest B?
Never got real life impact also. Your friendships.
Then there's, I think Harsh Dialogue has to be up there. A lot lah. I think recently would be Vizio lah. Vizio is crazy.
And what happened in those times? Was it just like you get messages or like your website traffic goes up, you get a lot of emails or DMs or what is that like?
Sometimes when we publish a story, we get sources reaching out, more sources reaching out. So we'll hear from like more sources, like, which is why we definitely, even if the story isn't where we want it to be, we want to publish. Because, we might hear stuff that we can't prove, right? We can't print, but at least we get something out there. We might hear from more people. Sometimes it's just quiet, which is great. We don't want to hear from complaints, right? Sometimes you get, it can really range. Sometimes like angry messages, sometimes, it depends.
So how do you deal with those angry messages? Because I'm sure they come from, the people that you are covering, or it could be my investors or something. Like how do you go home and feel like, oh, okay, I don't have to worry about looking over my shoulder, people angry at me, want to throw eggs at me and things like that.
I think as much as possible, we try to de-escalate. So we're like, so I think it's a whole, list of best practices. We're trying to craft to guide our journalists on how to de-escalate. Even before the story is published, we like, they'll say things to you, then you have to try to be professional, calm. Just portray yourself professionally. Same thing after, right? So I think de-escalate, if compromise, like if they want to issue clarifications, yeah, we can accommodate that.
Yeah.
Right. So give them something, right? So don't, yeah, try to meet them halfway as long as it's reasonable.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So I think, yeah, we just, it's just not worth it to enter into like a legal conflict.
Mm-hmm.
It's not worth it for, even if you win, right? So,
but has it happened? Like it, like that sort of legal conflict and all?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've received letters of demand quite a lot of times.
Do you all have like a counter in the office?
No lah. I think, yeah. We can probably count with our fingers. It's probably less than 20.
Oh, okay. That's fewer than I thought there would be.
Because like John Oliver, I know he said his whole legal team, like the goal of the content or creative team is to piss off the legal team as much as they can. Yeah, because they really go out and they get a lot of cease and desist letters.
Yeah, I think in the US you can do that.
Yeah.
Here it's challenging. Yeah. So, yeah, I think with letters of demand, yeah, seriously, they're wasting their money. Like, just talk things out. No need to bring in lawyers. Then they waste a few K writing the letter of demand. These days, I'll just respond myself and with a boilerplate, to try and just like, most often, you know, we just end up with some agreement, some arrangement, right? Mm. And say that, okay, yeah, we'll do this for you. Yeah, we won't apologize. Usually they'll ask for an apology.
Mm. Yeah.
They'll ask for, I don't know, apology is very common, right?
Yeah.
So we just say we won't, but we'll do this and this. And then we come to an understanding, and that's the whole Streisand effect, right? Yeah. You don't want to kind of blow things up, right? So I think, yeah, so I think my message out there to anyone watching is, reading is, I mean, listening is, yeah, just work with a journalist.
Mm.
The story may not be positive, right? It may not be be exactly what you want it to be, but it's better than just going that route, right?
And
unless, I mean, the journalist is totally, right, irresponsible, then fine, right? But yeah, it's not us, yeah.
So just alluding to what you're saying earlier, because I'm sure you've also made friends in the industry along the way and all, and yeah, those friends also might be working in companies that you end up covering and all these things. Like, do you find that a bit of a job hazard that, you know, your role as like have to be an independent, objective journalist versus some of these founders and all could actually hang out on a weekend or something, right? And next thing you know, you are like investigating the company. What do I say to them and things like that?
It's like when you meet your friend who's an insurance agent, you know, at the back of their head, they're like, oh, they're going to pitch you something.
Just sizing you up.
With Terrence, like, do they like, maybe before they invite you, like, okay, guys, we're not going to talk about this, okay? Yeah. Terrence is coming. Yeah,
yeah, we're going to talk about your family and all that. Oh, wait, yeah, maybe have you tried this insurance for your family?
Yeah, I think fortunately hasn't happened. Like, the people that you end up investigating, you probably wouldn't want to be friends with them. So far it hasn't happened.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Thankfully. Definitely. I'm not that close enough with the people that we ended up looking into. I mean, some of them did invest in that company, right? But yeah, I think so far it hasn't been an issue. Like, I'm not that friendly. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm. So I'd rather be in the office. I'm not like in the inner circle, right?
Mm.
So as a journalist, you kind of have to be a bit more detached anyway.
Is it a conscious thing almost?
In a way, because like, I think it's conscious in some way because like, I don't aspire really to be an investor.
Okay.
So I don't aspire to want to be invest in startups.
Mm.
So if I do, that might be a different thing, right? Yeah, like I think my I don't really aspire to be in the inner circle, so to speak. I mean, I enjoy the media business and working in media and trying to elevate it. So yeah, and so yeah, it's kind of deliberate. Yeah.
Mm. So you know, like from doing all this investigative stuff, where sometimes you see the dark side beneath all the fame and the glamour, right? Do you find yourself getting more and more cynical or more and more optimistic?
I think still optimistic. But yeah, that's a good one. Because I think, yeah, now we're talking about AI, right? Everyone's talking about AI and how that's going to change the world. There's always two sides to the coin.
Yeah.
That, you know, it'll boost your productivity, it'll do whatever, but there's obviously a dark side to it as well, right? In terms of the cheap labor they use to train the AI and how it might displace jobs and whatnot. So, I mean, I'm still optimistic by nature. Like, I still want to, how do I make use of tech, right, to improve things? So that still exists, but yeah, the world is a dark forest, lah. So, yeah.
So it means still balancing it out, right? Balancing it out.
Yeah.
And what about media in general, or even the tech space in not just Singapore but Southeast Asia? How do you see that developing?
Yeah, I think media is tough. Media is tough given, you know, you keep hearing about layoffs, right? Especially in the US market. I think SPH has kind of avoided that a bit thanks to the government funding. But it's something it has to grapple with as well. So it can't really escape that eventually. So it needs to figure things out, right? So tech, I think it's a bit of a down cycle right now given funding has been dry. And if you look at where AI is, where the talent is, it's all in the US. Right. So if you want to be in AI, the US market is, or Silicon Valley is where you want to be. So I think Singapore, it has to figure out its identity as far as the tech scene goes. Yeah, so what does it want to be? Yeah, who's the next Carousel, right? Who's the next shop back, right? So I think those are questions that they will have to figure out. But I think there's still funding coming in. So I think if you look at the early stages, there's a lot of angel investment, seed investment going into startups still. So hopefully that will pay off. And yeah, we'll see more like sustainable, financially sustainable companies come up that is able to grow organically and spending wisely. I think that's what I hope to see. Yeah.
Okay. But how do you, like you mentioned earlier, you no interest to invest in startups or that side of things. But isn't it like you see so many success stories? It's like when you go casino and you look at the table, wow, everyone's making money and I also should go and sit there and also try and make a big windfall for myself. Like why is it that makes you have the reverse effect of like, I don't want to be part of that whole gold rush?
I would say it's not that I don't, but it's like I haven't really seriously looked at it. Okay, so I think there's a conflict of interest thing as well.
Okay,
so
sure.
Obviously, I can't be investing in startups that I write about. I think that's that, but I think I do other investments, but it's more of it like in ETFs and whatnot. So yeah, startups, I think mainly it comes down to that conflict of interest thing and just not, I just don't have that strong desire to want to invest in startups because it can be high risk, right? Like for every, it's that saying, right? Every 10 startups, 9 fail or something like that. So you need that big winner. So you kind of need to spread your bets. So yeah, maybe just my risk appetite
But okay. Do you think like the whole startup thing, or even, you know, being a founder is over glamorized and overly sexed up?
Maybe for a period of time, right? And then like a few years ago, but now it's balanced, a bit more balanced, because you start hearing about the shit show that can happen, the layoffs, right? I mean, there's Zilingo, right? So, I mean, Shopback just had a big layoff. I mean, do you want to be the one to pull the trigger, right? So I think it's people are realizing that it's not as easy as, as what's portrayed maybe in the media, because the negative side is starting to come up a bit more.
I see. So I mean, like, still like going ahead, well, what are some of the big things coming up for Tech in Asia? Because I know like the glass wall thing you all launched was earlier this year, right? Any new things in the horizon, or any big changes that are coming up that people can look forward to?
We're going bigger into events and conferences this year. So we're heading to Saigon, we're heading to KL, we're heading to, we're still doing Jakarta. More AI coverage, I guess. So trying to figure out what our direction for that is. For Glass Wall, I'm not sure, because we didn't even know if it will take off. But now that it kind of did, so I think we are kind of thinking, okay, should we expand it, the scope a bit? So that's something we're discussing. I think one big piece we're working on is just using more AI in our work. So we're using AI to help us write news. We have a headline generator, so it'll like churn out 10 headlines for us, and then we'll pick the ones we like and churn out 10 more. Just using more AI in the background. So you won't even see it, you won't even know it, this AI. Using it to do mundane tasks like data entry. So it hopefully makes our work more interesting, because AI is like this intern, right, that comes in and does the stuff you don't want to do, right? So
how are you managing the fine line between letting the readers know, because you just said you have a headline generator, they help you write. But then now, you know, there's this big debate like, was this written by a human or an AI? Like, how do you discern? I think now even YouTube has, or Facebook, you have to disclose whether this was made with AI or not. How are you balancing that as a publisher?
I think first of all, readers don't care, right? I think it's more of an ethics issue, right? So readers don't care in terms of ethics.
Readers don't care? Like,
I don't think they care, Fundamentally, they care about the content, right? The quality. If it's bad quality, they'll ask, is this AI? But what they're asking is this terrible? Why is this so terrible? We're kind of workshopping it, but our approach towards disclosure is, to what extent was this article, this piece of content generated by AI? So, headlines, we get AI to churn out ideas. But more often than not, it's polished by humans, right? We make changes to it. So, in that case, we wouldn't disclose. Same with news. I think AI is really an intern, so the writing is also intern level. So there's a lot of polishing that happens before it gets to the final product. So we don't disclose. We disclose when we had this format called 50 Words, where it's like AI generated summaries in 50 words. We justified it. We disclosed it because, I think AI did more heavy lifting there. So I think it comes down to, for us, to what extent is AI involved? Like, let's say we use Midjourney to generate an image. Maybe the designer will do some touch-ups. We'll probably say that it's assisted, done with the help of AI. But to be honest, I don't know. I'm not very particular. I don't think it's a massive issue, ethical issue. Because at the end of the day, it's really about the end product, right? If the end product is good, who cares, right? AI only comes in the picture when, this looks bad, then people will start questioning, right? Did you use ChatGPT for this?
Yeah. So I mean, I always feel like the first draft, okay, use AI, but after that, you still need a human to really look over it and think about like, oh, the nuances of like culturally and everything like that. So that there still is the role for human, but like you said, like the intern role maybe is gone now, right? The first draft role.
For now.
Yeah.
Soon it'll be like the executive role.
Correct.
Manager role.
Moves up.
Yeah.
But I did want to ask you, like, you know, in light of everything, the layoffs and all that happening in industry, you know, in Singapore in general, we're just coming off the high of like hosting Taylor Swift 6 times, you know, exciting hub for talent and all these things. How do you feel about Singapore moving forward as like, you know, a talent hub for tech or for startups and everything? Like, a lot of people are talking about, you know, it's cheaper to do business in other countries, to set up a HQ in other countries, which you could have said about Taylor Swift's concert, like, it made a lot more sense for her to go to other countries, but, you know, she still chose to be here for various reasons, like, and the infrastructure and all matters.
Yeah.
How about the tech space? Like, what's the feeling?
It's pretty nuanced, right? So if you talk about the entry-level roles, the mid-tier roles, there's probably some worry that it's moving abroad. Costs going up, right? Rentals going up, GST. So all of that will increase the, you know, salary costs, right? So I think that might move away from Singapore somewhat, because now you have also have this remote working culture. I mean, it's more hybrid now, but I think it's still been quite persistent. So definitely, I think there's some worry there that for the mid-tier entry-level roles, that might have shifted overseas somewhat. You know, like some startups I know are kind of downsizing their offices, because yeah, I mean, they're not going to the office so often. So there's going to be some shift there for sure, and that's been happening, right, starting since COVID. But if you look at maybe the higher level, executive level roles, they just want a place that's safe, you know, that's convenient, that allows them to get from point A to point B in an hour or less. I think Singapore is still hard to beat, lah, if in terms of like safety and all of that. So I think for executive level roles, you kind of still want them to be in Singapore. And I mean, their salaries are going to be high wherever, lah, right? In Singapore or elsewhere. So it's not going to matter. Texas, pretty favorable here. So yeah, I think there's some worry for sure about how regional, maybe global companies are kind of downsizing their regional headquarters, and therefore, will there be less jobs here overall? But yeah, I don't really have the answer to that.
It's almost like, you know, you see in the movies and TV shows, like the main team is on floors like 10 to 14, then the boss is like at level 70 with the view. That's Singapore.
So Singapore's level 70.
Like Singapore's level 70.
I mean, cats,
not in a good way, not in a bad way, but because we talk about it a lot in terms of the future of Singapore, from policy level to society. And yeah, it's changing. Whether it's for better or worse, don't know. Like, did you go for Taylor Swift?
No. I mean, yeah, but I'm not a fan either. But okay. I know a lot of Swifties.
In your office?
In your office, yeah. One person, I'm not gonna say her who she is, but she went for like 5 or something.
Serious?
Yeah.
5. Jesus.
Yeah. And she just lost her voice.
Did she write an article about it or anything?
No. So yeah, but we were all just teasing her. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I had a colleague flew in from the Philippines to Singapore. Just for the concert. And before that, there was Coldplay as well.
Yeah.
And we were working on this story and about this company in Indonesia, and all our sources were in Singapore for the Coldplay concert. And they didn't respond to us because they were all at the Coldplay concert. So, I mean, yeah, I think overall it's a good move. I don't know. I think bringing Taylor Swift here, the exclusivity,
I think we were all quite shocked, right, at how the positive vibes that came out from organizing a concert. You didn't know that it would lead to that kind of media coverage. You didn't know it would lead to people like realizing that, hey, Singapore's a great place to live and work and all that. So there's a there was a mood of positivity, like in the aftermath of the concert. But yeah, I was just curious how that bled into, you know, in this ongoing discussion about whether Singapore can survive as a tech hub and all that. And media-wise also, in some ways, the fact that, you know, big personalities and stars are coming through our shores, that actually makes Singapore a much more interesting place to look at, right, for whether it's publications or anything.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, there's definitely some cohesive strategy behind that, like Singapore being this sort of like a destination and having all this infrastructure set up, right? So, yeah, I think it does help draw talent at the end of the day, and that matters, yeah.
Is there ever going to be like a Tech in Asia TV series, like a docu-series?
No, I think not. I mean, we do some videos, but yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I don't think, yeah.
Never say never,
Yeah, but tough, I think. TV is tough.
Yo, man, if you ever want to do a deep dive TV series, documentary series, we are always ready to talk.
In some ways, yeah, just related, the Taylor Swift thing, people understanding Singapore as a country, as an ecosystem, and even like these tech companies coming through Singapore and wreaking havoc, and then after that, leaving. I think now the backdrop is it's a more compelling story, like all these exposés about Theranos. Or,
I mean, even the TikTok CEO being in Singapore,
exactly. and having
global attention. It's cool. Like Singapore really feels like, oh shit, like we are kind of like the epicenter for a lot of tech stuff. So, I mean, it's interesting for us also. Yeah. Because, I mean, for us, that whole process was very eye-opening. And since then, we've also kind of been very curious about what goes on under the sheen of like startups. And also last time, I think when I used to see on LinkedIn, this company raises $10 million, I would feel jealous. I would feel like, shit, maybe we should think about it. But then now I'm like, whoa, that's a very loaded statement. You know, and whether it's a good thing or bad thing is also not clear.
Yeah. Yeah, sometimes they announce that amount, but did they actually raise it, right? Is that the question? Yeah. And you raise the amount, that's that responsibility. Yeah. I think, good, interesting thing you mentioned, the TikTok CEO, I think... I don't know, the fact that he's still Chinese, Singaporean Chinese, it still didn't shield him from that all the questions about are you affiliated to the CCP, right? Yeah. So I think that there's this notion of like bring in like a Singaporean CEO who's like neither here nor there might work, but it might not work, right? Because they still, yeah. I mean, partly, but you know, I think TikTok kind of shot themselves in the foot a bit when they were like, rallying their users to call their congressmen and whatnot, but that kind of backfired. But yeah, it does raises questions about, you know, whether Singaporean CEOs can still be seen as neutral, especially if like a Chinese guy, because the US Congress,
all the same
doesn't make a difference.
Yeah. Is that line of questioning an interesting one for you all? Like, just understanding that Singapore sort of sits between the US and China, and we understand the nuances, more of the nuances of each side, right? Mm-hmm. And that makes us quite in a good position. Like what you just said, when you say Singaporean Chinese, a lot of people in the West wouldn't understand what that means. People in China might not even understand what that really means. Is there plans for you to go in more into the exploring those side of things?
I think, might be tough because I don't know, there's already a lot of coverage of TikTok and that tension between US-China. So for us, it's a business question. You know, do we expand to that kind of coverage? Then how do we stand out, right? I don't think we've figured that out. Yeah.
But cool. I mean, for sure, he's now the Zeddy of the internet.
He's at the Met Ball and everything.
Met Gala. Honorary chair.
Yeah.
What is the Met Ball, Terrence?
That's the thing, I'm not from the US, right? I sit in between US and China.
Sit in between.
Yeah.
But cool, man. So for our listeners, where would be the best place to check out your website, which is techinasia.com? Mm-hmm. Any social media that you guys are on?
Yeah, I mean, we're on everywhere. LinkedIn, Telegram, WhatsApp, the usual Facebook, X, Yeah, we have an app, but that, yeah, that's more for subscribers. Yeah, I mean,
and I mean, even to follow you on LinkedIn, because like I give you credit, like LinkedIn is full of cringe posts, but I think you do a great job of writing stuff that doesn't make me go like, oh, fuck LinkedIn, fuck this shit.
Yeah, it's always that few people. I mean, they're talking about themselves a lot, and yeah, so
the formula, like, you know, the one line, you know, like. This was the toughest day of my life. And
some selfie of them on holiday.
Somewhere.
LinkedIn lunatics.
But cool. So for every guest, we do have the one segment we call One Shot Thing, which is to share something with our audience that you may have seen or experienced or something that that has brought you joy. So we'll go first. So you still got a bit more time. Terrence, you got your One Shot Thing?
I need to pull it up. Yeah.
Okay, so my one show thing was apparently there was a friendly match between the legends of Real Madrid and FC Porto, I think. And it was like the 51-year-old Zinedine Zidane was playing.
Oh, really?
And I mean, like for all those who maybe don't follow football, like Zinedine Zidane is one of the greatest players ever. Do you watch football?
Not really. Yeah.
So, but you heard of Zinedine Zidane?
For sure.
Yeah. So he's like
the headbutt. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So he also headbutted Materazzi in the World Cup final. But he's always been known for being a big guy, but so graceful the way he plays. And this one, he was 51. He's 51. And they also had some other legends like Roberto Carlos, Clarence Seedorf, and the way they play, right? You can tell, like, okay, like, they still got the touch, lah. And it's just nice to watch because I grew up watching like Zinedine Zidane, and you just see him play to that like with that ease and same signature style. It's very nice to watch, lah. And of course, you think, oh shit, these people are 51. Like Clarence Seedorf, still crossfield passes, still got like a top running guys over. Solid, man. Solid.
LeBron was, in the NBA, he's 39, right?
39. Like,
How is he still doing that?
It's crazy, man.
So
that's my one shook thing.
Yeah. Actually, my one shook thing also is football. It's just the recent, I think the friendly match also, the Liverpool legends versus the, which team was it? Ajax, the Ajax legends.
So like, it's like legends week, like all these friendlies.
No, so, I mean, I'm not very sure exactly why this tournament, this match was held, but I think the headline was that, you remember the old England manager, Sven-Goran Eriksson?
Yeah.
I think he has cancer. And he expressed that it was his dream to coach Liverpool. His lifelong dream. So they actually allow him to coach the Liverpool Legends team.
For one game.
And there's videos of him meeting Klopp and, you know, shaking hands and all these things. So, shit. I mean, it was just a nice moment, lah. I mean, you can be very cynical about everything, but you know, they just basically, he has no relation with the club whatsoever in the past, other than managing some of the, you know, Liverpool players for England, lah. But just to fulfill his one, you know, wish, like, it's a bit like what's that program that helps kids?
Make a wish,
yeah, for this guy,
Goran,
yeah. And then yeah, you know, they did it, lah. Yeah, so it was just nice moments of everything, lah. Yeah, I think, yeah.
Oh, solid.
Nice. Yeah, I've been watching a lot of TV, lah. So recently, I binged on Three Body Problems.
Yes.
Yeah, do you all catch that? Yeah.
I've read the book. Yeah.
Read the book, the whole series?
Just the first book.
The second and third is much better.
I know. What I tell people is that, the book was pretty hard to get through. The ideas are great, exciting ideas, but the book itself was hard to get through. Right? But how's the series?
You've
read all three books.
I've read all three books. So the books are great, right? So it starts from the Cultural Revolution in China, ends with the end of the universe. That's how grand the scope is. Yeah, series is okay. I mean, I wrote like a long spiel on Reddit to defend it.
Oh, really?
Because there were, you know, people there's some nationalistic thing as well, lah. You know, like how China versus US, and they were shitting on the Netflix series. I was like giving a moderate take.
The Singapore take.
Singapore
take,
right? Singapore take. Yeah, I said I'm neither American nor Chinese.
But I understand the nuances of each culture.
Exactly, yeah. So it's not bad, yeah. Quite bingeable. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the other show, I was watching a Shogun.
Shogun
is good.
But Three Body Problem, like, when you, I try to understand, like, because you're, you know, a journalist, everything. When you read the writing and all that, like, is it that... is something lost in translation somewhere, you feel? Like, especially for the first book. Because I was honestly having a hard time getting through parts of it, and I felt like, why is it written like that? Yeah.
For me, it's been years, maybe my memory's a bit clouded, but I think what I enjoy is the whole philosophical debate behind it, the grand ideas.
Yeah.
Yeah, so very imaginative. So even though, I think they were critiquing the characterization and how it's like a sausage fest or something, but and how like the Japanese women show always like the bad guys. So, but overall, it's really a grand ideas, which is why I like sci-fi and tech, right, by extension. So I like the Foundation series from Isaac Asimov.
I'm going through that now.
The TV show is very different, but,
from the book, is it?
From the book, but it is, I mean, there's Lee Pace lah. It's a god lah, right? So Yeah, so I enjoy a lot of sci-fi. Yeah.
Then after that, you go on Reddit and quarrel with
shit
people.
There.
Yeah, because it was like Sundays. I wrote that Reddit post under my real name.
Oh, really?
Just trying to get more karma, right? So okay, I'll write this. Not bad, I got good numbers. So so I'm done with writing on Reddit for now. I just want that score so that I can then post on Reddit Singapore. Because they have some requirement that you cannot post below a certain karma, right?
Oh, you mean that was your first post ever on Reddit?
No. I have other accounts.
Okay.
One under my real name. Might be useful in the future. God, who knows?
So you're using Three Body Problem to help you boost you into the karma space.
It worked.
So after watching and reading, you think people should still read the book first before watching?
Either way is fine. Yeah, because the Netflix series is very simplified. They cut away a lot of the plot. I would recommend Netflix and then
read.
And if they have time, watch the Tencent version, which is 30 episodes long and very draggy.
But you watched it?
I did. They can just cut it down to 20 episodes.
The ideas are really mind-blowing.
Once
you get to them, it's quite mind-blowing.
And it does, it's not the typical happy ending either.
Oh, okay.
No spoiler.
I'll just stop there. A bit bleak, but yeah.
Mm. Well, but cool.
Cool.
Awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks so much for coming on. In future also, if there's any other thing that that you feel you want to speak about, you're always welcome back.
You've earned the karma to come back onto the podcast again.
Last year they already earned lifetime karma. Lifetime karma.
Upvote.
Hall of Fame.
You have a Reddit channel, right?
Yeah, we do.
Yes. We have a very active Reddit community.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, of course, you can find the same stuff on Singapore and all that, but our community likes to write pretty long, about their thoughts about things and all. They don't just post and then make jokes or anything like that.
The only really one of them is Terrence.
One of them is me.
No, Terrence Lee.
Terrence Lee. Maybe he knows.
Yeah, he just checking. You all have a top rating.
I can post them there with my real name.
Once
the podcast comes out. Yeah.
We'll send you the link. And then if people have questions, put it there because Terrence Lee will make an appearance.
Say hi. Yeah.
Cool, man. Cool. Awesome. Thanks so much.
No worries, man. Happy to be here.
Awesome. And thanks so much for listening, everybody.